Hi, I'm Damon Fairless, host of Hunting Warhead from CBC Podcasts and the Norwegian newspaper VG. Hunting Warhead follows a global team of police and journalists as they attempt to dismantle a massive network of predators on the dark web. Winner of the grand prize for best investigative reporting at the New York festivals and recommended by The Guardian, Vulture, and the Globe and Mail, you can find Hunting Warhead on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hey there, I'm Rosemary Barton.
And I'm Elamine Abdul Mahmoud.
And this is Party Lines.
And Rosie, so many people are fed up with COVID-19, and they're fed up with the lockdowns, and they're fed up with how governments have handled this whole pandemic. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about what forms that anger can take and whether there's anything governments can do to address it.
And the federal government will present its budget this coming Monday, the first in 2 years. And with the economic fallout from the pandemic, pressure is on the government on a number of social policy issues, obviously concerns about how much they might spend. It could be the most important budget in decades. So we'll give you a sense of what you can expect.
So much pressure. Okay, let's get into it.
Let's do it.
Okay, Rosie, I want to tell you about a tweet. Can I tell you about a tweet? Is that okay with you?
Well, if it's a tweet I've never seen, please, yes.
I don't know if you've seen this tweet, but it was a tweet from over the weekend, and it was a tweet that was getting a lot of criticism. Like, people were just, like, tripping over themselves to make fun of it, and for once, it wasn't one of my tweets. It was a tweet from the city of Toronto, and it was, like, one of those perfectly sort of, like, banal city tweets that are, like, hey, friendly reminder, don't drink in parks, and if you're caught with alcohol, you'll get a fine. And I have to say that, like, watching the reaction of that tweet, I immediately understood the outrage. Like, it triggered something in me as well, because while I'm not an avid park drinker or not a park drinker at all, it just, like, felt like it was, it came out on the day that the province announced that it reached, like, this new peak of number of people in ICUs. All these people were responding to be like, is this really the message you want to focus on? Mm. You know, so many people right now are just struggling to get by. And it's like, if they're going to go outside to a park and hang out for a few minutes and maybe have a drink, is this really the biggest problem? Or do we have a larger problem going on here? And I found myself wondering if we've completely just reached the limit with all pandemic communication, like with how governments are talking to us about our behaviors during this wave. Because sure enough, the very next day, I woke up to these headlines of like vandalism and riots in Montreal. There was like it was mostly as a response to these new curfews that were put in place in Quebec. And it's worth noting that that curfew has been in place for a while, but the time was moved up. It was at 9:30 and then has been pushed up to 8 p.m. And that seems to be one of the reasons that these riots broke out. There was like really intense photos of shattered glass and trash cans set on fire in the street. In Alberta, there was a bunch of protesters who were chanting freedom and asking the government to cancel all the restrictions they just put in place. And I think in one clip, they were chanting lock her up about Dr. Dina Hinshaw, who's the top doctor in Alberta. And so I don't want to compare the tweet to the riots or the honestly, frankly, kind of like odious chants that we heard. They're not obviously not on the same level, but there's something there to me that pulls them all together, which is that we seem to be at a place in the pandemic where anything the governments ask of us seems to be no longer triggering informed comfort, but like anger, complacency, just fury in general. What's going on?
I think it's what we technically call fed upness. I think that's what we, I think that's the medical diagnosis, fed upness in the third wave. Yes. I think you're right. I'm glad you brought up the thing about parks, because oddly, the same sort of thing happened where I am in the nation's capital, where on Tuesday, Ottawa's mayor, Jim Watson, saw, I guess there were some people at a park over the weekend. They left a bunch of bottles behind. They didn't clean up after themselves. Okay, I get that's annoying. But he is now calling for an 8 p.m. curfew in city-run parks. And one of the quotes that he was quoted as saying is, there's no reason for people to be gathering at a park, particularly at night. To which I, like, my head sort of exploded. Again, I too am not going to a park at night to have a beer. But I think the reason people might be doing that is there's nowhere else to go. And I think that we have now come to a space where that kind of communication not only doesn't work anymore, but is also, is sort of living in some sort of bubble world where these leaders in particular, leaders like this, I guess they're not being sensitive to the way people might be feeling. There's a difference between asking people to follow public health restrictions, which I think everyone agrees still needs to be done, given particularly the numbers in Alberta, in Ontario, in BC, and in Quebec, versus condemning people for feeling frustrated, right? I think that there's a fine line that political leaders and public health leaders have to walk between understanding why people might be starting to, you know, get upset versus trying to find a solution for them, trying to find a way to make sure that people are okay through this very tough period.
I think that's exactly right. And like one thing that should be emphasized is that, at least as far as I can tell, most people are doing their best to follow the rules. At least the research is telling us that most people are willing to follow the rules that the government sets, but they're not necessarily happy doing it. So like this is a place where maybe we could do a bit more motivating, if that's even possible.
Right.
And Tim Caulfield, who does research into health law and policy, was quoted in the Post a couple days ago saying, just asking people over and over again to follow the restrictions isn't enough. We need to engage people. We need to listen to them. Well, I would for sure love to see a tone shift that is away from shame to something like, hey, this is hard. You've been doing this for a year. Help is on the way. Hang tight. I think it's really easy to dismiss the protesters. I think it's really easy to dismiss all that anger. But the hard thing to do is to sit with the anger and say, actually, like, part of this is valid. And maybe to push it a step further, go with me on this, is that maybe the reason people are frustrated is that they're not getting the response they need, because it might require governments to say, we did the wrong thing. Like it might require premiers in several provinces to say, we didn't shut down the economy when we should have. We didn't take the steps available to us when the experts told us we should. And now cases are out of control and we have no choice but to shut it down. That kind of requires a government to say, you know what? It was our choice that got us here. And that this is true, whether it's in Alberta or Ontario or BC. And we have to take responsibility for that anger. But, you know, the first political strategist to try that message might find themselves unemployed very quickly. So I'm not like holding my breath for that message to come out. But I think it would help if the people in charge said, yeah, we have some responsibility in the fact that we got to this place, but we need you to stick with us.
We should also say this isn't like unique to Canada or unique to a few provinces. There have been protests against lockdowns and general fatigue in around the world, in Spain, in the United Kingdom, in the Netherlands, you know, many, many, many different places. I don't think either of us are saying that there's any excuse for bad behavior like what we saw in Montreal, right? Or that there's any excuse for putting yourself and other people at risk, which is certainly what you saw in Alberta because people were not wearing masks, were not physically distanced. But I think there is something to what you're saying, to the need to be aware of the difficulty people are in, or the hardship they feel, or the frustration they feel after being in this space for so long. But I will say this, some leaders have allowed this to brew and even fed into it in a different way. And here I'll point to the Premier of Alberta, Jason Kenney, who is not only faced with this amongst the general population, but also inside his own caucus, where there are 17 members of the caucus who believe that he should not have put in place the latest round of restrictions, shutting down indoor dining, indoor gatherings, and retail. Kenney has, in the past, used language himself, which certainly, I think we can fairly say, downplayed the state of the pandemic. Now, admittedly, this was early on in the first wave last year, where Kenney called COVID a, quote, influenza, and he said that it was only dangerous to the elderly. Now, that was May of last year. I don't think in May of last year that anyone still thought it was the influenza.
Yes.
Certainly, we knew that elderly people were more vulnerable and more likely to die. But I don't think anyone thought that other people were immune to getting ill and even potentially dying. So by using language like that, which Jason Kenney, when called on it now, says that he didn't say those things, even though we know that he did. He almost sort of feeds into that impression within parts of the population in Alberta that it isn't as big a deal as it really is, as we've now seen. And I wonder whether that shift in language, too, is problematic for when the moment then comes months later where you have to say, please, I need you to follow the rules. I need you to hang in there. It becomes hard, I think, for your credibility as a leader to make that plea, right, to your citizens.
Yeah, I think this is where politics becomes much more of an art, in the sense of you want to have as much credibility as possible for when you're asking people to do hard things like this. Yeah. And a lot of these leaders have spent a lot of time minimizing that credibility or taking hits of that credibility. Like we've seen over and over again in Ontario, for example, the education minister come out and say, schools are safe, nothing's going to happen to schools, we're going to keep them open. And then a week later, or in the most recent case, literally a day later, the premier saying, we're going to close schools. People need to feel that the people in charge know what they are doing. And that actually requires the people in charge to say, you know what, we didn't know what we were doing in this instance, but now we are back on track. And when you don't have that, I think the entire system begins to fall apart, because like it's understandable that people need to vent right now, because they're just looking at what they see as haphazard rules applied. And they're like, okay, what is the logic guiding all of these?
I will say, though, as much as we talk about how leaders need to lead, people also need to do what's best, right? They need to listen very closely to what public health officials are saying right now, whatever their region is, and they need to follow those rules. The rule that I abide by is if I don't need to go, I don't go. And that pretty much allows you to not do anything, but it also means that you're not putting yourself and others in harm's way. And I think while we can be sympathetic and understanding of the frustration and the impatience and all the other things happening there, we also, as you said off the top, like we just got to hang on.
You know, I think it would be fair to say that we have been in a deal, in a relationship with the government for the past year of saying, okay, we will do our part. We will do the thing that you're asking of us. And in exchange, you will manage the rest of this. You will manage the distribution of the vaccine. You'll manage the healthcare system on our behalf. You'll manage the rules that will keep us safe.
Right.
And the polls are telling us that, by and large, most people are following those rules. So when we get to this place where I think people are being asked to continue to follow these rules, a lot of people are frustrated because they're saying, I've spent a year following the rules that you've told me. I've only gone to the malls when you said they're safe and you opened them and you said, you know, we'll allow 25% capacity or something. So we get to this place where maybe it feels to people like the government isn't holding up their end of the bargain. I saw several Twitter threads about people who are saying, I'd like to go book my vaccine appointment. They try to book their vaccine appointment. They show up in person and they tell them, actually, sorry, like that doesn't apply to you. Even though the day before that, they'd heard their premier say, you know what, you are now eligible to get the vaccine. That is a failure on the part of the government that it just goes unanswered, and it just adds to the exasperation that people have. And so these things end up piling up, because then you look at the government and say, you're not holding up your end of the bargain.
On an evening in early December 2018, the young CEO of a cryptocurrency exchange reportedly dies while on his honeymoon in India. This death is not announced to customers for another month. And when they're told Gerald Cotton is the only person to hold the passwords to their funds, conspiracy theories grow, leaving some to wonder, could Gerald Cotton still be alive?
Honeymoon, moving the body, all the missing money. It was like, but what happened?
A death in cryptoland. Available now on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
Because I'm older than you, and I've been in Ottawa for an infinite amount of time now, it seems. I remember back in 2009, so this was like coming out of the 2008 recession. Don't worry, this won't go on forever.
And I love it.
And at the time, the finance department released a report about the government's deficit. The year before, they had a surplus. And then the following year, they had a, get ready for it, 5.8 $8 billion deficit. And
oh,
it,
man.
Yeah, no. And it was, oh my God, what are we going to do? How will we make our way out of this recession? Will we ever balance the books? And I tell you this story, Elamine, because here we are in 2021, and the Parliamentary Budget Officer is projecting that our deficit this year will be $363 billion. Obviously, obviously, these are extraordinary times. We've done things and lived through things that we never expected. But this coming Monday, for the first time in 2 years, we will finally get a close look at not only how much the government has spent in detail, the state of our finances as a country, and whether that deficit is bigger, smaller, whatever, and then sort of what the government plans to do in the months ahead. And it's going to be tricky because they're going to have to find a way to deal with the crisis we are still in and think about how we get out of it. But I mentioned that example back from 2008 only because sometimes the hugeness, the enormity of the spending that has happened over the past 12 months, I think becomes sort of lost on us. Like we get used to hearing these huge numbers. But it hasn't actually been like that for so long. And I think we need to keep that in mind when we hear all the things the government wants to do and the new spending that it wants to put in place as well.
Well, you know that feeling when you have like a big project due and then you say, well, like I need more time to work on it because it's going to be amazing and it's going to be airtight and
perfect. Are you talking about your book here?
Yeah, 100%. And then, you know, my editor was like, sure, have more time. But then it better really deliver. You know what? That's actually kind of a perfect analogy because that's what it feels like.
Yeah.
Like the Liberals have put themselves in a bit of a bind by delaying this budget so much. Mm-hmm. Like at first it was, okay, we need to be responsive to the virus, so we're not going to do this budget last March. And then we kept on rolling out these massive programs and there was a desire to understand just what it was doing to our financial baseline. So we got the little snippets, you know, we got the fiscal snapshots and the fiscal updates and the fiscal telegrams and the fiscal, I don't know, Polaroids, whatever you want to call
carrier
them.
Carrier pigeons.
The fiscal carrier pigeons, absolutely. And then we heard this talk of the Liberals saying they're ready to spend $100 billion on the recovery. And of course, that creates a headline or two for the day, but it's actually like, it's pretty nonspecific. And the budget is a chance where you get to show where you're going to put that money, where you're going to actually, like, if you're going to ask the country to go into that much debt, what are you going to do with it and how is it going to help us recover? And to that end, like, leading up to this budget, we've heard so much about the plans to spend really big on childcare, for example, which is really important because a lot of women are out of the workforce because of the pandemic. And if they're going to re-enter the workforce, it's going to have to be through a pretty ambitious childcare plan, a pretty ambitious childcare solution across the country. We've heard about a focus on the green recovery, but we haven't yet heard about how these things will help the country, like how much will be dedicated to them, and then like how much we can expect to get out of those programs. And so far, like the conservative argument has been that, like, look, the Liberals are saying this and it's going to be risky because what you really need right now is a sound financial manager, and the Liberals are going to spend all this money left and right.
Mm-hmm.
But here's where I think there may be trouble for the government is that this money was meant to be spent in a recovery when we're ready to like accelerate out of this thing. We know this from what they told us back in the middle of the second wave, that they're like, we're going to hold this until we're in that recovery. Well, we thought that that would be the end of this thing, and it's not. We are in worse shape, and they're stuck having to position a recovery budget while we haven't even close to recovered yet.
Yeah, I mean, I think the risk to the government, and this is something that Chrystia Freeland just said recently, and the Conservatives have been tweeting out through the week, is that they take a, quote, political opportunity, that's the language she used, and at a time when maybe people don't want to see the opportunity taken, right? When it looks perhaps too early to take the opportunity. If the government didn't go ahead with this stimulus, the Parliamentary Budget Officer, who's sort of like an independent watchdog who looks at government finances, points out that we would be doing fine. We, you know, the pandemic spending would go away, growth would return to where it was, which wasn't huge, but still, and we would maybe have a deficit of $121 billion next year instead of, you know, more than 300. So the government needs to somehow explain to Canadians why what they're going to show us on Monday is needed and why it matters. And as you say, some of it you can sort of understand. If you're trying to address the problem of women, for instance, being forced out of the workplace and just trying to be more supportive to families and create more productivity in the economy, yeah, childcare seems like a smart way to probably help people do all those things. They say that it'll be, you know, 70 to 100 billion over 3 years, that will create 3 to 4% growth inside the economy. Those things all sound great. But I think the government then has to make the case about why that's needed right now, as you say, and why they're making those choices instead of others. For instance, I haven't heard in this city, although I don't see a lot of people, I haven't heard much about the National PharmaCare Plan, which the Liberals ran on in the last election and were committed to starting. So are they still going to start that? Or now, because of the pandemic, are there other social programs that are more important to them? And Liberals have promised childcare for many, many, many years. Why is now the moment to do that? And do they really have a mandate from Canadians to go ahead and try and create a national childcare program over the next 3 years? I mean, I think these are all things that we have to think about moving forward. I'm not saying that one is good and one is bad. I'm just saying if the government now, for the first time in 2 years, has to look at the sort of the big picture of what we're dealing with right now, and then create a case, make a case for why it's putting that kind of spending in the window again, that is politically challenging. And I can see how the Conservatives are going to push back on that, right? Because that's where that opposition is going to come from.
Yeah. The thing is that the budget being a political document is going to be now more interesting than it being a recovery document, because we are in this like really tricky window where maybe a couple of months ago it would have even seemed possible to have. Do you remember we were talking a couple of months ago about like there might be a spring election? With this spiking wave that we're having right now, that seems to be off the table. Like nobody seems to be interested in the possibility of an election in the next 6 weeks, because there are very few places in this country that have the virus under control. So that actually, I think, fundamentally changes the nature of the document, because now it also has to be a document that stands up and says, okay, we don't want an election right now. Like, this is how we're going to build bridges so that other parties can support us. And this is a pretty open opportunity for the NDP, I think, while the Liberals can't have an election in the next little while, to ask for more for that support, because I think it would look worse for the Liberals to trigger an election while we're in the middle of this spiking wave.
Yeah, and the Prime Minister, to that end, has met with opposition leaders this week, or talked to opposition leaders this week about things they want to see in the budget, because he continues to say that he doesn't want an election for all those reasons that you said, even though opposition parties say that he does. So you're right. It has to be a document that A, can garner some support if he doesn't want an election, and that will help Canadians through this, hopefully, the last part of this crisis. But I do think it's important to remember that it still has to be a budget that he is prepared to run on if there's an election, even if it's not this spring. It has to be something that he's willing to put in front of Canadians when he gets there. That is the sound of people gathering in parks, even though their governments are mad at them. Anyway,
yes,
do what is best for you according to public health restrictions. Okay, it's also the sound of last call. I just don't want to be endorsing people to get in trouble.
Yes, I hear you.
Last week we
wanted
Yes, well, of course you do. Last week we wanted to know how you feel about your province's pandemic response. So we asked, what kind of actions do you want to see from your provincial government right now? Do you feel they're doing enough to curb the spread of COVID-19?
And y'all people wanted to talk about this one, so we got responses from all over the country on it. One listener in New Brunswick went with the report card approach, gave the government there a B+ for response and messaging, and a C- on vaccine rollout.
Okay, a listener from my home province, Manitoba, yo, said Manitoba is doing just enough to curb it without upsetting their PC voter base, because they have a conservative government there. Case in point, masks aren't mandatory in churches, but they are in all other public spaces.
A listener from Ontario tweeted a picture of Ricky from Trailer Park Boys that had Worst Case Ontario on it. That's one of his most famous lines from that show. It's brilliant.
I would not have known that had you not told me that. another one from Ontario, the listener says, our provincial government has failed at every step. I had hoped that with experts' help, a proactive plan would guide us through this mess. Sadly, I truly believe decisions were made with hope for the best, not protect from the worst as the plan.
And we heard from someone in Nova Scotia who said, I give our Nova Scotia government a 9. A 9! Canadian government a 10. That's presumably out of 10. Those are really high marks there.
That's pretty impressive. One from Quebec. Living in Montreal, I feel like it's a mixed bag of not doing enough. Vaccination for essential workers versus too much. Curfews. The constant change of rules certainly adds to frustration, although grading becomes clear when it looks at how Ontario's mismanaging it.
Well, it's good to have a base mark, I guess. And finally, to the West Coast, listener writes, I'm in BC and confused about whether Dr. Henry thinks she's a PHO or a politician. She seems to be making decisions to keep people happy rather than safe. It's her job to make unpopular decisions that will save lives, and she puts those off as long as possible.
Strong opinions, and a lot of them.
Yes.
We love it. We love it. So this week, we want to ask you this one. Do you feel that your government is holding up its end of the pandemic bargain? This can be your provincial government, your municipal, your federal government. Just tweet us. I'm at Rosie Barton.
And I'm at Elamine88. Throw in the hashtag. The hashtag is Party Lines, and let us know what you think.
And that is it for Party Lines this week from CBC News and CBC Podcasts. I'm Rosemary Barton, Chief Political Correspondent for CBC News.
And I'm Elamine Abdul Mahmoud, Chief Drinking Just Lemonade in the Park and Culture Writer for BuzzFeed News.
All right, I'll see you back here post-budget next week.
You betcha.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.